Jess, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Hi, how are you doing today on May 9th, 2012? I've got a real interesting show for you today, and I can't wait to get started. But first, I want to let you know what's going on in my real world. ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com is my nonprofit website. Lots of great information there. We are going to be attending a number of events this weekend, the Brooklyn Food Conference. If you're in the New York City area, they are expecting thousands of people. There will be over 150 workshops, and I'm going to be in two of them. I'll be at the Corporate Power Diet and Animal Agriculture Workshop from 12:30 to 1:45 p.m. and the Women, Feminism, and the Use of Animals for Food from 2 to 3:15. It's going to be a great event, and I'm just excited to know that there'll be all these people that are really interested in healthy food for our own personal health, the health of our family, the health of the planet. I think there'll be a lot of innovative, creative ideas there. I may not agree with all of them, but I think for the most part, we're all aligned on a lot of similar issues that we want our food pure, clean, nutritious, organic, primarily locally grown, fresh. And it's great that we can all come together and support each other. I can't wait to feel the energy this weekend at that event. And then at the end of the month, the Veggie Pride Parade, May 27th. And I will be giving one of the pep talks that are going on during the day. That's going to be a really fun event, May 27th in Manhattan. Check out the website is veggieprideparade.org. And the Brooklyn Food Conference is bkfoodconference.org. All right, so let's get really started here. I'm going to bring on my first guest, Annie Fio, who is a premier celebrity raw food chef. She has appeared on numerous TV shows, including Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods, the author of 6 books, including Annie's Raw Food Kitchen and Annie's Raw Food Asia. She is also the host of the online video series, Annie's Raw Food Kitchen Show. She lives in Los Angeles. We're going to be talking about her latest book, Annie's 15-Day Fat Blast. Welcome to It's All About Food, Annie.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's really great to be with you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
I always enjoy talking to you. You always have that vibrant, happy energy.
Happy. What better state to be in than happiness, right?
That's right. And, you know, I mean, we know that our food has such a great connection to how we feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we're eating the right foods that are actually nourishing our body, supporting us with vitamins and minerals and all these great nutrients and enzymes and amino acids, then our body is actually being fed like rocket fuel instead of some low-grade unleaded or something, you know, then that means that we can like hum like a well-oiled machine. So all those nutrients are orchestrating all the trillions of cells in our body and our brain to make, you know, clear decisions. And then we just feel better overall because we're healthier, we're more vibrant, stronger.
Does everybody hear that energy just coming out of her voice? I mean, it's just jumping. And when you read your book, the energy is just jumping off the page. I mean that.
Thank you.
I forgot to mention, if anybody wants to call in and ask any questions, I know raw food eating is kind of curious and popular with a lot of people. You can ask any questions you want. The number here is 1-888-874-4888. You can also send me an email at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. I am plugged in right now. And, of course, you can send me an email anytime during the show or during the week. All right, so the energy's jumping off the page here. And, you know, life is so challenging. Everybody's got stuff. Doesn't matter what part of the economic continuum you're on. We all have our challenges. But life is so much easier to get through when we're nourishing our bodies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we're not adding, basically when we nourish our bodies with the right foods and the right nourishment, then what we're doing is we're decreasing nutritional stress. And so I always think of 4 different categories of stress. You know, in life, as you said, we all have stress. Most of it's emotional stress. So mm-hmm. we have responsibilities at work, for our family, just life. That's all just normal emotional stress. That's one type of stressor. And then there's environmental stress. which comes, like, I live in LA, so, you know, there's polluted air, there's like, you know, pollution in the water, there's environmental toxins that come from outgassing from, you know, paints on our walls. We can't really control that. To some degree, we can, you know, have plants in our environment. Another place that we get stress is physical stress. So, you know, when we exercise, that is actually good for our health, but it does release free radicals. So those four categories of stressors, when we exceed our amount that our body can take, is when we get sick. So if we're decreasing the amount of stress that we put on our bodies by choosing different foods that are healthier, that don't take as much energy to break down, that are more familiar to the body, that give us, you know, vibrant vitamins, minerals, all that kind of stuff, it actually also saves us energy, decreases the stressors, and also decreases the toxic load, but also nourishes our body to make us stronger. Then we can actually take on more of those other stressors in life before we get sick.
Right, and they may not even seem like stresses when our body's nourished.
Absolutely. When I first discovered raw food, the thing that just made me just flip 100% was that I just immediately, with one meal at dinner, I realized, I noticed my mental clarity, my ability to focus. I got so much work done. I pulled an all-nighter for a presentation the next morning. I rocked it the whole night thinking, oh, I'm going to have to go home and take a nap after. Gave the presentation, went off great, and afterwards I didn't need to take a nap. I was so excited. The presentation went well. The clients were happy, and I felt really good. And that's when it really clicked. I was like, what was in that food that it actually... Yeah, and it helped with productivity, and then I don't even need to sleep.
Okay.
Right? And so I'm not saying that not sleeping is a good thing.
Exactly. We all need to sleep. That'll get to you after a few days, but sleep is really important. You know, a lot of times when people say they're tired, the first thing I ask them is if they're getting enough sleep.
Exactly. And in today's culture, right, like coffee is so popular. Everyone grabs coffee. Mm-hmm. We think about why we grab coffee and when we grab it, it's because we're tired. So if we're like a battery, our battery's already depleted. It's sort of hitting the red area. It's not in the black, it's in the red. But instead, we take in caffeine to trick ourselves into thinking we have energy that we really don't have. And so we're then further depleting that battery to like sub-red, like, you know, danger of the battery zone. But with raw foods, if we're actually using superfoods, there's certain superfoods, like I love maca. So if I do like chocolate, which is a little bit of caffeine, mostly theobromine, but a little bit of caffeine, I'll couple it with maca. Because the maca is an adaptogen that will give us energy because it's actually rebuilding our adrenal glands and making us stronger. Hmm. We actually feel energized because our body and our vitality is becoming stronger. And that's very different than tricking the body into thinking it has energy it doesn't have, versus actually nourishing the body to be stronger, to feel more energetic, because it is more energetic.
Maca. Now, where does it come from, and where do people get it?
It comes from Peru. It's from the Andes, and you can get it at any natural, you know, health food store. It comes usually in a powder form, sometimes in the supplement section, a lot of times in the raw food section, and it's a tuber, so it grows underground, and it looks like sort of like a small potato. They dry it, they grind it down. So even though it's processed, it's just the whole food. It's like, you know, that food is dried, it's ground into a powder, it's then packaged. So we could put like a teaspoon of it. You want to start, actually some people start with a half a teaspoon. You can go up to a tablespoon. But it's an adaptogen. It strengthens our adrenal glands. It strengthens and balances our endocrine system. Mm-hmm. So it's really wonderful for perimenopause, postmenopausal, like hormonal balance. It's actually known to be a natural Viagra for men as well. And again, it's because...
Let's repeat that one. Natural Viagra, maca powder.
Exactly. You don't need the pharmaceutical. You can just get it from a whole food, superfood source. And so the reason that that's happening is because it is increasing our overall vitality and health. So when we become stronger and healthy, of course, we're going to be more vibrant. That's why it would then act as a natural Viagra, right? So
right.
It just increases, you know, whatever, everything, fertility, vitality, just everything.
You know, you mentioned some point in your book, I remember reading it, about the cost of eating healthy, and you really brought up some really good points. It's all perspective, how we see our life and what we're spending our money on, not just in the moment, but in the future. And you realize the value of eating healthy foods, even if it may seem a little more expensive in the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really, I think a lot of people, especially with the economic challenges with that our economy, I think a lot of people have gone through some challenges and they've realized, you know, I may lose my health care,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it may be expensive to get my own health care. So what can I do to actually, you know, that's preventative care? Or how can I maintain my health so that, you know, I'm more healthy, less likely to get an illness or have to pay for expensive health treatments? And so, you know, a good thing that's come out of that, I think, is that a lot of people have decided to grow their own food. That's the best thing ever, right?
Absolutely,
to, like, have
yeah.
our garden. Yeah, it's just wonderful. Like, even in, like, Detroit, right? Like, the citizens of Detroit took over all the public land and started growing farms and produce. How
yeah.
wonderful is that?
Urban agriculture is really exciting.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's so great. So they're in control of their food supply, and that is really the best way anyway, because then if you think about, you know, like most of the food we buy at a grocery store, you know, it travels at least a week if you think about it, right? Because the farm has to pick it, they process it, they put it on a truck, it travels to wherever they manufacture it or package it, it sits in a warehouse, and then it goes to the store, and then we go to the store, we bring it home. When we grow our own food, or second best is even going to a farmer's market, that food is picked a few hours prior.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes such a difference. When you go out in your yard and you pick tomatoes and then you use them right away, that is like liquid sunshine and life force energy. That's like so vibrant. Whereas a tomato that maybe, you know, at a store may have been picked green and then gassed along the way because they wanted to stay fresh on the shelf longer, right? So it's not picked at the optimal time. So when we can choose local and seasonal, that is actually when the food is at the peak of its flavor, but also the nutritional profile gives us more for our money. We're actually getting more.
Okay, so you wrote this book, Annie's 15-Day Fat Blast, and a lot of people, this is the most popular topic, how to lose weight, feel good, and do it quickly. And this is your solution. So let's talk a little bit about that and why you think it works.
Oh, I think it works because people have been already getting the book early, and they've been posting to my fan page, to all my Facebook pages. So I recommend everyone go and check it out. But the responses have been amazing. The biggest response I saw was somebody who lost 19 pounds in 15 days.
Wow.
Somebody else just now posted that they lost 15 pounds in 1 week. So I was just confirming that. But on average, people are like, yeah, I've lost 6 pounds in the first 4 days. Like, it is already being proven that it does work. There's tons of comments. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I develop a book, my testers, they test the book, but they're already in the lifestyle. They sort of already have the flavors. They enjoy these flavors already. So to see, like, people outside the community and mainstream people enjoying the recipes, liking the flavors, and getting the results is really amazing. So what I've done is basically taken raw food concepts. So if we eat whole foods that have no fillers, no empty calories, they're just nutrient dense, we lose weight on accident without even trying.
Right.
And so, yeah, so I just basically repackaged this concept of raw food into a diet plan. It's a 15-day diet plan with recipes. It's a menu plan. It has shopping lists. I've broken it into three phases. So the first phase is all blended. So it's shakes, smoothies, soups. And it's really just to get the body cleaned out and detoxified immediately in a quick 3 days. And then the second part of the first week, the next 4 days, is phase two. It's also, I've now taught the reader to add on nutrient-dense shakes and smoothies to really nutrify the body and to fill up on water and fiber and all those nutrients. And then by the second phase, we're adding on a salad and more solids in the middle of the day, still having the smoothies for breakfast and for dinner and for snacks. And then by the second week, which is days 8 through 15, it's just a raw food diet. And again, we're using the shakes to really help nutrify the body, to get, like, really dense nutrition into the body. And what happens when we nutrify the body, my theory on obesity is that when we eat empty calories, our body's actually starving for nutrition. And so,
yep.
like 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, we grab for a bag of chips or some other snack, and we just keep eating and eating because the body's
hungry.
Yeah, the body is starving for nutrients.
Yeah.
And so when we're eating nutrient-dense food, then we get satiated much earlier, more quickly. We don't have to eat as much. And so that's really the idea. But also what I've discovered and I identify and utilize are four basic components of their types of ingredients. So one is a thermogenic ingredient, thermogenic ingredients actually accelerate metabolism and body fat burning. So one is chili. Capsicum, which comes from chili, is the active ingredient that is found in diet pills. So I'm just using chili because I'm not going to recommend that people take diet pills.
Right.
We're using chili. We're using green tea. We're using cacao, which has a little bit of caffeine, mostly theobromine. Things like that. Ginger, you know, pineapple has bromelain, which is an enzyme for burning that decreases inflammation. So I'm actually using ingredients that accelerate fat burning in different combinations. Another category are probiotics. So probiotics are, really great for aiding in digestion, aiding in breakdown of food, assimilation, and then elimination of toxins. And then another is prebiotics. So all fruits and vegetables are basically prebiotics, and they feed the probiotics.
Mm.
And then the last category is medium chain fatty acids. So the only place that we can find medium chain fatty acids are in butter and buttermilk or coconut oil. And, you know, there have been numerous studies. All of my facts here are cited. They're all backed by scientific research. So I'm really happy about that because all this stuff is backed with all this research they've done. But medium chain fatty acids actually help to burn belly fat. And so I'm basically combining ingredients from each of those four categories of foods in different ways throughout each of the three phases to synergistically increase fat burning and belly fat burning during that 15-day program.
That sounds pretty good. And it all tastes good, too.
Yeah.
So one of my goals is to get more people to just move along the food continuum, eat less meat and dairy, and eat more fruits and vegetables, and we'll see so many benefits for that. And I know many people have different fine points or specifics about plant-based diets, and I'm probably more in line with your approach than many others, but I just wanted to talk about some of them just because it's people are always confused. And for example, Dr. McDougall has a new book out called The Starch Solution, and Dr. Joel Fuhrman, I'm a big fan of him, he focuses a lot on dark leafy green vegetables. You mentioned Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn in your book, and he's had a lot of great success with heart disease. But do you know, on his website, there was a lot of flack about this recently. I just wanted to bring it up because I find it kind of amusing. He writes in the question and answer thing, he does not promote smoothies. He says avoid smoothies, and he says not to juice, and he tells people to avoid oil. I don't agree. I don't think he meant to say exactly what he's saying on his website. There was a lot of confusion on the internet a few months ago. I don't know if you caught it, but people were all kind of crazy because some people were saying don't have blended salads. I personally think they're very nutritious.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the goal is. Some people will say don't because they feel that it actually weakens our digestive power.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Basically, what we're doing when we blend is we're allowing the blender to chew the food for us so that when we drink it, it decreases the stress that our body has to, you know, work to digest and break that food down. So to do that now and again, and if you're just doing that all the time forever, yeah, that would be not ideal. But to add on a nutrient-dense smoothie or shake in that manner, that actually is what helps make that food and those nutrients more easily assimilated into the body.
Right.
And so for something like a juice as well, if somebody, this can get a little complicated, but if somebody has been eating a standard American diet for their whole lives, they could have a lot of mucoid plaque buildup in their digestive tract. It's literally like having a rubber inner tube lining your inside of your digestive tract. Imagine when you eat something, it's struggling to break down, and then those nutrients may not be absorbed as easily because your tissue is covered in like this mucoid plaque that's actually blocking the absorption.
Ew.
So those cases, that's why detoxes are important, and that's why raw food is naturally detoxing because of all the fiber and the water. So that's why, you know, a lot of people will do detoxes at least once a year, if not once a season, to help. It just overall will break that down, and then that means that the foods we eat are easier to digest and break down and assimilate the nutrition from. So if somebody has that, a juice, a green juice, is a wonderful way to bypass that mucoid plaquing to get those nutrients straight into the bloodstream because there isn't There's no breaking down of that food. There is no fiber.
Oh, I'm a total proponent of juice. I've been juicing every day now for a long time, and I really believe that I'm here on this planet today because I've been juicing. It's a great way to supercharge your immune system, no question about that.
Absolutely. I just love it. So sometimes when I'm really starving, like, you know, I've been so busy recently because I'm promoting this new book, and so there are days when I can't even think about what to eat, and I'm actually, like, really hungry. I'll just juice. I just grab really quickly all the vegetables in my fridge, mm-hmm. and I'll juice, like, a pint or two, and I drink that, and it's amazing, but it's satisfying, and I get full, but then I don't have to worry about malnourishment because I know that I've gotten all these nutrients into my body, because to make, like, a pint of juice that takes, like, a huge bowl of vegetables and greens,
yep.
much more than we can eat, right?
That's
so
right.
What, like, wheatgrass juice, like 1 ounce, one little shot of wheatgrass juice, is so dense in minerals and vitamins, but I think it's equivalent. Is it equivalent to 12 pounds of vegetables?
Oh, I don't know the number, but it's good.
It's
just good.
Like
the thing is, though, unfortunately, a lot of people don't like work. They don't like cleaning up. And I'm always saying you're worth it, and it's a gift to yourself to juice and then clean up afterwards. If you think that you're giving yourself something, the cleanup doesn't seem so problematic, at least in my opinion. But with blending, and you have all these great recipes for blended salads and blended soups, how easy is that?
So easy. There's no cleanup. You just throw everything into the blender.
There's no cleanup.
You blend
yeah.
it, and then you rinse. It's like so easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I actually find then you just drink it. So you know, it's easier to actually just drink. So people will find, too, that, like, especially on phase one and also on phase two of my 15-day plan, you actually have more time in your day. Because if you think about what it takes to actually go prepare food and then plate it, sit down to eat it, you know, that it takes at least like 20 minutes or half an hour, you know, but instead, if you're just throwing everything into a blender, blending it in like 2 seconds and then drinking it, that is so much faster with no cleanup. It actually saves you a lot of time.
I kind of go down both paths. So I realize I appreciate the value of being able to do something quickly. And I know for a lot of people that will help them eat better. But I also think it's important to plate your food, do some beautiful presentation, sit down together with people you care about and enjoy the meal. Both of those are important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really important, I think, to share food. And especially, it's always important to share food because that's why I love food so much, because it brings people together and then you're like around the table and you're all sharing food, breaking bread together, raw bread. But I find that especially in the beginning, like, so many of these wonderful raw food potlucks and things like that, you know, they've really popped up everywhere. And to have that community and support and then also inspiration, like you go there and you try someone else's recipe, and you're like, wow, that was so good. How'd you make that? And then it's just so exciting because you're discovering all these new foods and tastes and textures. And it just makes it a lot more fun when we're sharing the food with friends and family and community.
I just came back from Costa Rica, and when I'm there, I stay in a very undeveloped area. And one of the things that I love about it is all of the fresh tropical fruit. I just kind of really go nutty over it. And you really realize, oh gosh, you know, I love technology. I love progress and development, but we really need to get some balance with it because there's some things that we've just forgotten. So many of our foods today, the processed foods, come so overly packaged. I love bringing a papaya when I'm leaving Costa Rica to the airport because it's naturally packaged and I can sit down and cut it open even with a plastic fork or something. It's really easy to open up. You scrape the seeds out and you can eat it anywhere. It's so satisfying. It's fresh. It's full of, it's hydrated and yet it's got some density to it. It's just, that's my favorite airport food.
That's awesome. That's wonderful.
And then I brought some avocado with me and another papaya. And it was funny because my friend and I were eating on the plane together on the way back to New York. And everybody was really envious because they had these disgusting dry packaged foods. And we were having a feast.
I never understood that either, right? So I was always taught that, you know, when we fly, for every hour we fly, you want to consume about a liter of water.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's already so dehydrating.
Right.
It's already to be on an airplane. And then they serve all this, like, lifeless dry food that's not hydrating at all. So that is the best thing. A papaya, you know, things that travel really, I always travel with like cucumbers, celery.
Cucumber, carrots, good. Mm-hmm.
You know, jicama, you know, apples, they all keep really well out of refrigeration, but they're juicy and they give us that, that delicious, like, hydration while we're flying.
Right.
It's a great way to stay hydrated.
And fortunately, unfortunately, I don't know, you have to eat it all before you get through customs because they won't let you bring food into another country.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, right. Especially fruit.
Yeah.
Because of the bugs on it and stuff.
Yeah, so raw food, I'm not telling people that they need to eat all raw food, but we definitely need to eat a lot of it, and you should get to know your food. Apples every day, easy, pack easy. I don't work in an office, but when I used to, I just bring in a big bag. You don't have to refrigerate them. They're there when you need them, packaged naturally, perfectly, and they're satisfying.
Exactly. Because that's the whole thing, I think, right? We're all on the same page, is that we're just encouraging everybody to choose directly from Mother Earth and avoid things that come from a factory or that are processed. Or, you know, so like apple, you literally just pull it off the tree and it's like that.
Yeah.
Cucumber, right? Or a papaya or whatever. So that's it. I mean, it's not even necessarily a matter of like, I know some people hear the word raw and they get scared. It's not. I sort of think of the word raw as just whole food straight from the planet. Just like, you know, we use raw lumber or raw stones to build a building.
Well, it seems the vocabulary that we have today, just coming back to what already was, we have to find new words for. Like we call food that's not treated with pesticides and herbicides, we call it organic. And if it's treated with toxins, we call it conventional. How crazy is that?
It's so crazy. But, you know, organic, I was so shocked that about a year ago, I discovered that organic means organic chemicals.
Yeah. Annie, we have Eric from New Jersey who has a couple of questions. Eric, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I had a couple of questions, and that was interesting that you guys are going to cover about the organic chemicals. There's a ton of those. It's been watered down like crazy, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So could you... If you have a moment, please cover, how do you prepare nuts? Do you soak them, like, in hydrogen peroxide to kill some parasites? Because, you know, you never know how long they've been lying around, and then making smoothies out of them. Do you combine them? Do you follow food combining laws, like, you know, nuts and oils and proteins is not good to combine with fruits, better with veggie smoothies? And also, as far as combining the veggies and fruits together in the same, you know, smoothie or whatnot, because I've heard it's better so that you don't spike your sugar high in the blood, to combine like 60-40, 60 veggies and 40 fruits. But then there's also the other side saying it's not good to combine the veggies and fruits together.
Okay, Annie, what do you think?
Well, ideally, they say you should have everything separately. Now, for fresh fruits and fresh veggies, you can combine them together. I mean, different people have different outlooks on that. So if somebody has weaker digestion and they're getting bloating and they're having trouble with certain food combinations, it's always best to just either mono diet or stick with one category of food. So, yeah, then it would just be just vegetables or it would just be just fruits. But most people can mix fruits and vegetables. Ideally, though, in an ideal world, if you want to be really extreme, they say it's not the best because you're mixing up the different digestive enzymes in the system. And so that may sort of put more stress and wear and tear on the body. But I mix those things together, and I don't have a problem with it. I think where the issue comes in is that a protein, so something that's a heavier fat protein, which you had mentioned, like a nut, and boil, those fats, they actually sometimes take up to 2 hours to break down, digest, and then leave the body. And so if you're eating a fruit that takes 20 minutes to break down, like a cantaloupe, an orange, whatever, and anyways, besides, I actually always gravitate towards low glycemic fruits anyway, but they take about 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes to break down. If you eat a heavy nut first and then eat a fruit, you can imagine the fruit is like a Ferrari that's ready to pass through the system, but now it's being stuck behind a moving truck, you know, this big truck that's like slowly going down the system. And so what happens is that sugar starts to break down, it starts to ferment, and it's stuck and it can't exit the body. It's stuck behind the heavier protein. So then when things ferment, like when we pickle vegetables and stuff, it actually creates pressure, it creates gas, it creates bloating. And a lot of times when people have trouble with digesting, it is sometimes, or a lot of times, during food combining. And so I think especially when people start to first transition into more of a whole food diet, if they're getting that kind of bloating, then it is, we should pay attention to the food combining. But in general, like, I personally don't really worry about it.
I'm with you there. I believe in keeping it simple, Annie, and what you first said originally, listen to your body, see how you feel. A lot of people have no problem at all combining fruits and vegetables, and I give the body a lot of credit. I think it's really smart. I think it knows how to handle protein, carbohydrate, and fat all at the same time. But if there's some food that gives you a problem, then don't eat it or don't mix it with other things. It's that simple.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. I think we've come to the end of our part here, Annie. So thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for writing 15 Day Fat Blast, and thanks for making this world a better, happier place.
Oh, thanks to you too, Karen. It's been lovely to speak with you.
Yes, it has. And one day I will meet you somewhere and we'll share a shake. Okay, thank you. That was Annie Fio, 15 Day Fat Blast. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and we will be right back with Richard Schwartz talking about who stole my religion. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Next part, are you ready? I am going to bring on my guest, Dr. Richard Schwartz, who is Professor Emeritus, Mathematics College of Staten Island, President of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America, JVNA, and co-founder and coordinator of the Society of Ethical and Religious Vegetarians. He is best known as a vegetarian activist and advocate for animal rights in the United States and Israel. His writings inspired the 2007 documentary film A Sacred Duty, Applying Jewish Values to Heal the World, directed by Lionel Freeberg. His latest book, Who Stole My Religion? Revitalizing Judaism and Applying Jewish Values to Help Heal Our Imperiled Planet, can be read in the ebook form freely at whostolemyreligion.com. Welcome, Dr. Schwartz, to It's All About Food.
Oh, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Great to be with you.
I am so in awe of all of the work that you have done to this point, and I look forward to everything you're going to do in the future.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're very kind.
Yes, well, we're both a bunch of kind people, I think.
Well, we try.
We do.
Sure.
Anyway, so you have this great new book out, and I just wanted to say this show is called It's All About Food, and we have talked before on this show, you and I, about vegetarianism and how important it is for our health and for the environment, and how you personally apply the Jewish philosophy to the importance of being vegetarian. And one of the things that I find most people, I'm not going to say all, but most people who move to eating plant foods, when they discover that they don't need to kill animals to eat and to thrive and to live, it opens a whole new perspective about life and our planet, and we start to realize more and more all of the exploitation that's going on, all of the suffering, all of the pain, and it's connected, I believe, to all kinds of issues on the planet, environment, politics, mm-hmm. everything that's going on in the world.
Right.
And you really hit on it in your book, Who Stole My Religion?
Well, thank you very much. We try, and all because, as you say, the switch to vegetarianism is so important, perhaps more important than ever today, as the world is very unfortunately rapidly approaching climate catastrophe, major scarcities of water, energy, and food. And it's essential that religious groups get involved. It's essential that everything possible by everybody be used to avoid these catastrophes. And it's also essential that there be a major shift toward vegetarian diets in order to have even a chance to reach a sustainable path.
Now, what I like about your message is certainly you're applying Jewish philosophies to the points that you want to make, but these points apply to all of us. I'm not a religious person. I was raised Jewish. I like to celebrate the holidays for the songs and for the food and for the gathering of the families, but I don't follow the religious protocol. And there are many other religions on the planet, but these points that you bring up are basic, moral, essential points that really should be the foundation of all of our lives.
Well, absolutely. What I try to do, for example, in Judaism and vegetarianism, is point out that there are six fundamental mandates that point to vegetarianism as the ideal diet for Jews today and really for everybody, because all the religions are based on compassion and sharing and justice. Anyway, I want to just briefly indicate these six mandates are not necessarily in any special order, but to take care of our health, to treat animals with compassion, to be co-workers with God in protecting the environment, to conserve natural resources, to help hungry people, and to seek and pursue peace. And just one other point related to that, the two ideal times in the Jewish tradition are both pictured as being vegetarian periods. Those are the Garden of Eden at the beginning, because in Genesis 1:29, God's first dietary regimen was strictly vegetarian. And the ideal time that Jews yearn for, the Messianic period, also considered to be vegetarian by Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cohen Cook and others, based on that powerful prophecy of Isaiah, that among other things, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, the lion will eat straw with the ox, and no one shall hurt nor destroy in all of God's holy mountain. So this is a challenge. I'd love to get into a respectful debate on should Jews be vegetarians, should people in general be vegetarians, but there's a lot of denial out there, a lot of stonewalling, and people just want to avoid the issues.
Yeah. Well, we do welcome questions. If anybody has any comments or questions, the number is 1-888-874-4888. There's so much going on, especially with the internet today. Lots of information. Some of it's great, some of it's not great. And the thing that frustrates me the most is so many people gravitate towards information that gets them all red in the face and all fired up, and it's very misconstrued, and it brings out a lot of anger. It doesn't promote any good, really, and it just separates the sides. It keeps us all full of anger, and it's not solving any problems. And you explain a lot of that, especially in the beginning of the book, when you're talking about Jewish people in the United States and their voting tendencies now with the Democrat and Republican parties.
Right, absolutely. First of all, I make a very strong case that Judaism is a radical religion. I'm very positive on it because the powerful teachings on peace and justice, etc. And I'm part of a modern Orthodox community, and there, too, the people are kind and involved in charitable work, many positive things. But unfortunately, what I'm finding is among the Orthodox in Judaism, many have turned to the right. Many, unfortunately, are in denial about climate change in spite of the almost everyday evidence of floods and storms. Polar ice caps are melting, the glaciers are melting, etc. And they're supporting a party that is more and more for the wealthy, for corporations, rather than for the middle class. And we're seeing many, many examples out in Congress and the deadlock where the Republican Party, for example, well, in 2010, all the senators then signed a statement that they would not let any further legislation go forward unless they were guaranteed that the wealthiest 1 or 2% would not be taxed any further.
So, yeah, it's kind of crazy. We've certainly seen our government's been very frustrating the last few years where we're not getting anything done because nobody wants to compromise and everybody wants their own way. And we're seeing over and over again that that small 1% seems to win out all the time.
Absolutely. But I think the Democrats have been willing to compromise in many cases, but many of the Republicans have signed statements that no matter what, they're not going to vote for a tax increase, and the taxes for the wealthy are far lower than they've been under even previous administrations, even when they were Republican. So much has to be done. So much is needed, you know, to create jobs, Our infrastructure is crumbling. A lot has to be done on that, and that would create jobs, bring in more tax revenue, reduce the unemployment benefits, and hopefully get our economy back. So that, I agree with you. And I mentioned in the book that a lot of people see things in terms of black and white, good and evil, mm-hmm. us versus them. But I think it's important to try to find common ground and solutions.
There's a lot of emails that go around, and they highlight certain things. Very often, many of the points are out of context. So people can make a point that's not really valid.
Right.
And and people pass these things around. They go viral, and everybody gets angry. What I would like to see is in the early part of your book where you list lots of different things that have happened in government, lots of votes that went one way or another based on Democratic and Republican parties. I'd like to see all of that in an email that gets spread around and goes viral.
Well, I would love that. And any part of it, and as you very kindly mentioned at the beginning, the threats are so great, the denial is so widespread, that I am making the entire ebook, 385 or so pages, freely available to everybody. And all people have to do is go to our blog, as you pointed out, whostoleourreligion.com, and a little scrolling down right under a picture of the cover, they can actually download the ebook. And I hope people will do that, read at least part of it, pass it on to others, because it's essential that major changes soon occur. You know, people often say, well, climate change maybe 50 years from now, maybe 100 years from now. But we know it's happening already. Some islands in the Pacific have been inundated and all that. And as I say, glaciers melting, and that's going to be a big threat to future irrigation and farming. And more severe climate events are occurring. This past March, 15,000 plus temperature records were broken in just 1 month, the warmest March in recorded history.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
well, the thing about the thing that I don't think most people realize, we live in the United States, many of us, in a great deal of abundance, to the point where many people are obese. They're eating all the wrong foods and they're getting lots and lots of calories. But at the same time, where we have all this, all these great technological innovations to enable us to produce a lot of food, there's still tremendous amount of poverty and hunger. And I was really surprised to read that even in Israel, there's a great deal of poverty and hunger.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is a lot of poverty, and the poverty gap is growing between the wealthy and the poor, as it is in the U.S. And again, part of it is because of the power of money. I wish everybody was wealthy, and I don't begrudge anybody that, but I think the problem is when the wealthy use that wealth in order to cut out regulations, you know, and do things that will increase their wealth at the expense of everybody else, that could be a big, big problem. And, you know, that's why I try to address issues like that in the book. As I point out, Judaism has these powerful teachings on justice and peace, and the important thing is to put them into practice in trying to build a much more just, sane, healthy, environmentally sustainable world.
So let's just get a little bit away from food for the moment, even though I know it's all connected. There's this Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it's in the news all the time, and things are really getting interesting now with the whole Middle East kind of in revolution. Where do you think we should be going? What's the Schwartz solution?
Well, unfortunately, time is not on Israel's side, it's not on the Palestinian side, it's not on anybody's side, and it's difficult, and they've been working on this for years, but, you know, with two children in Israel, and I make a case, you know, for Israel and the many positive things they've done, but unless somehow there is a just, comprehensive, sustainable resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unfortunately, Israel will not be able to avert renewed violence, be able to solve its economic problems, and you mentioned the poverty growing, its environmental problems, and by the way, they've had a 7-year drought, got a little bit more rain this year, but somebody just told me today they need 10 more years like that with extra rain to get things back to normal. And also, Israel would not be able to remain both a democratic state and a Jewish state. So I think it's essential that there be this resolution, and hopefully it will be tied in with what some are pushing as a global Marshall Plan, you know, patterned on a Marshall Plan after World War II, where much of Europe was restored by U.S. providing aid, etc. So I see the importance of a global Marshall Plan that would use a small percent of the gross national product of developed countries, and maybe a lot of that from the military, because there's so much spending on the military nowadays, with the U.S. spending almost as much as all the other countries combined on the military. But anyway, using a small percent of that to try to sharply reduce poverty and hunger and illiteracy and disease, pollution, climate change, etc. You know, it's almost like a dream, but it's very important, because hopefully that, combined with an Israeli-Palestinian peace, would bring much greater prosperity to that area and to the whole world, because now there's so much violence and conflict, and as you say, we have great new technology, great new possibilities. So hopefully we'll get some good leaders that will point these things out and lead us to much greater cooperation rather than always conflict.
There's a part in your book where you talk about the Muslim Community Center, what some people term the mosque that is being built near Ground Zero. Can you just talk about that and give me your perspective on what's good and not so good about it? Because there certainly was a lot of energy and anger about that. We're not hearing much about it anymore.
No, well, that's faded a little bit, but it wasn't just that mosque, but there were other mosques that were under attack and other parts of the country. And you mentioned before about all the misleading information. You said sometimes out of context, sometimes it's just completely false that is being passed around, anti-Muslim material. Now, I'm completely against terrorism, no matter who is doing it, etc. But thank God Muslims in the U.S. have been very helpful in many areas, making great contributions. Somehow, as I say, we have to find common ground. As far as the mosque, certainly the feelings of the victims of 9/11 have to be taken into account. Well, some of those were Muslims. Some of the Muslims were first responders. So, and that was a fair distance away in a major city like New York from the World Trade Center, you know, from Ground Zero. So I think that could have been a way of bringing people together. That mosque was supposed to be modeled on the 92nd Street Y or the Jewish Community Center in Manhattan as a place where not only Muslims would be using it, but all kinds of people. You know, it wasn't just going to be a mosque, but a real center. And it could have been bringing people together. As a matter of fact, one of the advisors is a rabbi who's director of the Jewish Community Center in Manhattan. So, unfortunately, sometimes for political reasons, people are stirring up all kinds of negatives. Of course, we have to be watchful in general with regard to terrorism and all. But once again, I mentioned that global Marshall Plan, where we work together in some of the poverty and hunger, disease, illiteracy, et cetera. And unfortunately, you can never completely eliminate evil and terrorism, but I think that could go a long way toward reducing it.
I absolutely believe that if we focused our time, energy, finances, resources on providing food for people and education, all the problems would go away. Everyone wants the same thing. Everyone wants to not be hungry, to be fed, to be with their families, to pursue their interests, the basics, the real basics. And if everyone around the world had them, oh, it would just be an amazing place.
Well, of course, I agree 100%. That's why it's really something, you know, I call animal-based diets now sometimes madness and sheer insanity. When you realize that an estimated 20 million people are dying of hunger and its effects every single year, and almost 1 billion people are chronically hungry, according to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, and yet in the U.S., as I say, madness and sheer insanity, we're feeding 70% or more of the grain to animals destined for slaughter. And what makes it even more madness and sheer insanity is we're taking very healthy products like soy and oats and corn, other grains, which are high in complex carbohydrates and fiber. And after feeding to animals, we get meat products which have no fiber, no complex carbohydrates, and are very high in unhealthy saturated fat, cholesterol, and animal protein. So that's why I say that a major switch to vegetarianism is not only an individual, very important individual choice for people, but really a societal imperative. And when you realize the contribution to climate change, the greater threat to humanity, that adds to it.
We just have a few minutes left. Can we talk about kosher and raising animals for kosher food? And is it any different or is it any more compassionate? I know that it implies that it's more mm-hmm. compassionate.
Okay, well, the so-called laws of Shekhita, or ritual slaughter, were designed to minimize pain. A lot of people say we should only use the bolt stunning method, but if you read that book, wonderful book by Gail Eisenitz called Slaughterhouse, you'll see there are many problems in the non-kosher slaughterhouses as well. Mm-hmm. And also, because of today, modern mass production, even if ideally Shekhita minimizes pain because things are done so fast, it's not always carried out properly. And also, unfortunately, on the factory farms, whether kosher or not, in general, animals are raised the same way. So I always argue that even if slaughter was ideal, minimize pain, can we forget the many months that the animals are so mistreated on factory farms? I'm sure in previous programs you've probably had many discussions of the incredible horrors.
Yes.
Egg-laying hens who can't even raise their wings. The males are killed right away.
Well, I was surprised. I remember a while back, I forget what website it was, but I was looking up kosher food, and there are some pictures of a company that sells kosher chickens, and just looking at the pictures they're showing, you see all these crammed chickens on the mm-hmm. floor, thinking, why are you even showing this? It looks horrifying to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's far from the ideal, because Judaism does have powerful teachings on compassion for animals. According to the Psalms, God's mercies are over all his works, including the animals. Book of Proverbs says the righteous individual considers the life of his or her animal. Many teachings are part of the Ten Commandments. Animals as well as people are supposed to rest on the Sabbath day. But unfortunately, reality is far from the ideal, and that's one reason I use that title, Who Stole My Religion? Every religion has such value if really practiced, you know, for the compassion and the teachings about justice and peace and sharing.
Yeah, they all, I'm not a religious expert, mm-hmm. but my understanding of many of them is based on some really basic, simple, good principles. And somehow all this hypocrisy floats in and power gets involved and people mm-hmm. get distracted, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's
what's the response like? You're in an Orthodox community. What is it like when you share your ideas with your synagogue and your Jewish community?
Well, unfortunately, as I think Mark Twain is credited as saying, denial is not just
not
a river
just
in Egypt.
Right. I say that all the time.
yeah. And people are unable to respond to my basic points. I said I'd love to be in a respectful dialogue debate on should Jews be vegetarians, should they be environmental activists and all. And that's why, to some extent, I chose that title, Who Stole My Religion, to try to really challenge people to a larger extent. So I get a lot of kidding in my community about vegetarian, and I don't mind it because it shows that they're sensitized to the topic to some extent, but somebody pointed out it's harder to change a person's religion than to diet sometimes.
But, yeah. Well, we're at the end of the show, so thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz. And I recommend everyone go to whostolemyreligion.com, download this free ebook. There's so much wonderful information in there. Also, you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, and I have lots of different holiday recipes that are traditional and yet vegan, many gluten-free. You can have your cake and eat it too, and do it compassionately. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and have a very delicious week. Thank you, Dr. Schwartz. Be well.